cold at this time. It really doesn't work to have it off there. This is a third session of the interview with David Fetherman, and it's now the 27th of March.
Well, maybe we should pick up with my departure from the chairmanship of Rural Sociology. At the time, I was also heading off to the Center for Advanced Study at Stanford, which was in 1978-79 academic year.
What wins you that that appointment?
Well, there is a national board of advisors to the center. That board's made up of former fellows primarily. There is also a board of directors. That's the sitting board, but the board I was referring to is the temporary, more informal board of advisors whose advice is solicited annually to provide, on the one hand, fresh nominations for potential fellows, and on the other, to evaluate and rank a slate of potential fellows that's presented from the prior year's nominations. The process, therefore, begins with and by a nomination. The nominees are asked to provide information, CVs, and a list of references. That kind of information is collated along with the responses from this national board of rankers and evaluators. All that is put on the table of the sitting board, which decides on several criteria who should be invited to take up a fellowship. Those criteria being, on the one side, the very obvious criteria of quite visible scholarship, visible in a national or an international sense. Second is someone who is apt to benefit from having been a fellow. That often means someone who isn't at the very, very end of academic life, but that doesn't exclude such persons. And it may mean someone who's not in the very, very beginning of academic life, but those people aren't excluded necessarily either. And the third criterion is that that person might be regarded as an interesting co-fellow and enter eagerly into the intellectual life and social intellectual life of the center. It is, after all, a small college for a year's time. The numbers of fellows reaches, between, say, three dozen and 40, perhaps, somewhere in that range, coming primarily, though not exclusively, from the United States. Dominated very heavily by psychology as a discipline, with from year to year variations in the subdominant discipline, often being sociology or economics or mathematics, and a wild card, physician, filmmaker, a publicist, a novelist, what have you, philosopher. This is a setting to which I was introduced by a name now quite familiar in my commentary about my professional life. It's Bill Sewell. Bill had been a fellow, and I believe at one time had been on the sitting board of advisors. It was on the occasion of the American Sociological meetings, I believe, that were held one year in San Francisco, that Bill and his wife took me and my wife up to the center just to drive through and walk through the grounds. And I met Preston Cutler. Preston Cutler was Ralph Tyler, who was the founding director, or the director at the time of the founding in the early 50s. Preston Cutler was the sort of day-to-day manager of the center. He handled all the details of soliciting information from and about potential fellows and handling their affairs once they arrived in situ. And Preston was a marvelous character. He, among the first things he showed me, I recall, was this marvelous cactus garden that he and Robert Merton, a very famous sociologist, had planted outside one of these studies, outside the so-called Merton study. By the way, Preston began the tradition of keeping records on who occupied which study over the years. And now fellows get a printout of, if you're in study three, you get a printout of these days of who the eminence
That's fancy.
You would see oneself in the in the company of all these many and grand people over the years.
You don't scratch your names on the wall.
No, you don't have to. You get a list, and you're forever inscribed on
idea.
The list. But in any case, I met at that time Preston, and it was some years later that I had correspondence and became a fellow. In any case, that's how one becomes a fellow, and I became one the year after Bob Hauser was there. You may recall from our previous discussions of having worked together, I had spent a few days that previous year working with Bob in his study on various versions of chapters of our book, and at that point had made some plans for housing and so on for the next year. The center is a the center year, when it works well, surely must work well in different ways for different people who are at various stages of projects, and the last thing anyone wants to do, it seems to me, is to take work as usual to the center. For example, my year, some poor soul came with the editorship of a journal and kept it for that year and seemed to do nothing more than occupy a phone booth for a goodly part of the time. That probably doesn't mean much, having said a phone booth, but there are no phones, or were no phones in the studies. It's a marvelous idea. You actually had to walk out into the rain to go to a telephone, that's exactly the way the world ought to be for academics.
But we never do it.
That's right. That's right. But for me, what made the situation just right is that I had, in fact, completed a book. I was planning a slow transition into a new emphasis away from the study of social mobility and the intergenerational patterns of inheritance of socioeconomic standing and economic standing and so forth, and to take up some of the earlier interests I had had in socialization and how children were reared and how they develop psychologically and socially as a function of their social settings. Part of the reason that I was interested in social psychology for the duration of my graduate study was because I was able to focus my attention on these kinds of issues even while I was working with Duncan, because my part of that enterprise was really the parent-child part of it, the social psychology part of it, the motives, the achievement motives, and how they develop intellectual ability, school abilities, and how they develop, and so on. So I was going back to that now after the OCG project and the books with Bob. What I didn't know, again another one of these serendipitous features of my academic life, what I didn't know was that year Gardner Lindsay had assembled, Gardner Lindsay is the director of the Center for Advanced Study, had assembled as one of his working groups a set of perhaps 8 to 12 fellows who came from psychology primarily, developmental psychology and gerontology, to focus on aging and adult development. those persons included Matilda White Riley, a very famous sociologist who's now president of the American Sociological Association this year. Paul Baltus, who was perhaps the most leading and prominent figure in the renewed interest in so-called lifespan human development. James Birren, one of the leading gerontologists from University of Southern California. John and B. Whiting from Harvard, the anthropologists. Margaret Clark from University of San Francisco. And I'm sure I'm leaving some out, whom I'll think of later on. But in any case, I was not aware that that group had been formed. These groups are formed primarily to assist the director in getting some extramural funding for fellows. This is a feature of the diminishing funding pie for the social and behavioral sciences, and so places such as the center, which formerly were able to provide full salary support out of Ford Foundation, National Science Foundation funding, had to now resort to putting proposals into mission agencies and foundations to support special projects that fellows would work on. These being maybe the write-up of a series of papers that they'd all worked on and published them as a book, something of that sort. In any case, there was a group in aging and human development, adult development. And it turned out that that was, for me, one of the most exciting and influential happenstances of my most recent academic period. It enabled me to meet with, I actually did join that seminar, though my funding wasn't connected to it. I met with that group on a weekly basis for the duration of the year. I developed some very strong collaborative ties with, particularly with Paul Baltus, who after he left the center went on to become a director of one of the Max Planck Institutes in Berlin. And in addition, was asked to join one of the Social Science Research Council committees that many of those people were members of, a committee that was formed roughly at that time, that is in the very middle or late 70s, in the council to bring some influence in the way that particularly child development had influenced developmental thinking in psychology, almost to the exclusion of attention, any attention, serious attention, to the question of whether adults develop, and if so, in what respect differently or in the same as children, and to be a bridge between the gerontological interests, which were becoming more and more interested in how one becomes old rather than in the problems of being old, and the developmental work that had been so focused on the very early years of life, on the probably erroneous, it was becoming clear, assumption that there was something critical about the early socialization or child-rearing experiences that had a overwhelming effect and preeminent effect in the shape and course of later developments. So the council had put this committee together, charged it with reviewing some of these basic assumptions in light of new results from longitudinal projects of formerly these child-rearing studies that are now some 20, 30, 40 years old, and to see whether new views were not warranted. All that was happening at that period, and I was invited to sit in and participate, and it was probably the most facilitating set of events for someone who had decided beforehand to spend all that year sitting and reading and redirecting and thinking about what to do next as an empirical project or as a sheer writing project. Out of it came a couple of very specific and, as it turned out, very influential opportunities. One was to write a position paper for the committee, for the Social Science Research Council committee, in response to a request from the National Science Foundation, which was putting together its five-year outlook on science and technology. It was really a thought piece that was to go into a forward-looking science policy focusing document published by the National Science Foundation. So I spent a good part of the last segment of my fellowship year and the following summer working on that document, and it was published in several places. One of them was the National Science Foundation document. Another was a National Academy of Sciences document on whither go the social and behavioral sciences, and it was the sort of the new Bass report. This is goes back several years to a very influential document in shaping the terrain of for the development of the social and behavioral sciences, and so that work got very good exposure, and it's been cited quite a lot. So it was a marvelous opportunity to sort of, how should we say, put a new signpost out or a new shingle out of taking down the David Fetherman Researcher of Social Stratification and putting up a new one, and it certainly got a lot of attention.
So it had something to do with what you had thought of going out there to do, but was really a departure from that. You said sibling...
Well, it was much more confined. My plan was much more confined to the, how should we say, more conventional way of thinking about child socialization, families and kids. And suddenly to be exposed to a revision of that whole view, or a, how should we say, a revolution, really, intellectual revolution, in which that many of the common assumptions that had gone into that genre of research were being strongly, if not attacked, and at least taken apart piece by piece and held up against the light of new evidence and new studies that hadn't existed before, long-term studies that one could evaluate the question of whether early events were so very much more important than the more recent events, and whether we crystallize a kind of basic personality and there's only modest amounts of embellishments of thises and thats at the surface later on, or whether there can be fundamental changes, and of what character, and why not, other kinds of changes that aren't maybe so thoroughgoing. And I never really thought about old people, never in my life. It never seemed to me intellectually interesting. But I learned that it was for me important to take a lifespan perspective, that is to see old age as a piece of the full course of life or the full life cycle, and ask the question, well, is there something connected? Is there some connection between development and patterns of development as we understand them and aging as we understand it? How can you interrelate what we label as growth and development on one hand with aging and decline on the other, in order to come up with what is for me now a new conceptualization of both aging and development. It's something I've been working on intellectually since I finished this synoptic paper that I just described. A statement for me of a new theoretical orientation to the study of both aging and development, which is integrated, it's set within an evolutionary framework. It is multidisciplinary in the sense that it draws for its basis out of evolutionary and population biology, as well as psychology and sociology. And that statement, too, is an agenda for a new round of empirical work, which is still a bit off in the future, but in short, the experience that year took me far afield from what I expected to do, but frankly, I was set to go in that direction, given the pushes, I went a lot further.
Had your work for on the occupational changes in the generation given you some basis with which to approach what you were doing?
It certainly did. In fact, a good part of my fellowship year was spent explaining the implications of that work for a new conception expanded conception in the minds of particularly psychologists of what social class meant. My conception of social class is a much more dynamic conception. It's not some kind of static structure into which one is born and in which one lives forevermore. And the lecture that I gave to the center, several fellows are asked over the course of the year to give the weekly lecture, it's an honor to be asked, and because not everyone does get a chance. And my lecture was really about the question of how much opportunity is there in America, and that was just the how should we say, a more popularized question that allowed me to talk about what we had found about the nature of socioeconomic inequality in the United States, how much of it was transferred from one generation to the next, mm-hmm. and how, what are the mechanisms, and whether that transference, that transferal of inequality was a process that was getting stronger or weaker, where opportunities, were destinies more tied to beginnings in the more recent time than in the past, and so forth. So it gave me entree through the fact that I was interested in intergenerational problems. I was interested in problems that were dynamic in their very framework, that had a lifelong character to it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the synoptic piece that I wrote about lifespan research and lifespan conceptions that frame the human life cycle in various disciplines, I used as some examples for sociology this very work in social stratification of the Duncan genre that represented a lifespan, life course perspective in the study of social inequality and social mobility, and differentiated it from the more static conceptions of the old Yankee City Warner School of studying social stratification of the 50s, for example, that seemed to be what many of the psychologists of the generation represented at the center seemed to have in mind when they thought of as studies of American stratification. They thought of those 1950s style studies, which are certainly not the genre of the Duncan School.
So you brought an important ingredient into what they
as
were
as it
thinking
turned
about.
Out. Yeah, I think that's probably so.
And fortuitously, because you weren't even expected to be a member of the group.
Right. Exactly. Hmm. Exactly. It's important, I guess. That year was important to me in many respects. I've talked about some of the intellectual ones, how ideas got connected with other ideas. There's a social side that's very important too, and I alluded to that at the outset when I talked about Matilda Riley and Paul Baltus and some others and the SSRC committee. Matilda Riley has played an abiding role in both sociology and in the wider social science community in organizing professional activity, particularly in the social sciences, but also in the biological sciences as well, around questions of aging and the life cycle. One of the first textbooks I read in discovering sociology was a Riley and Riley textbook she and her husband Jack had put together on research methods in the social sciences, and they chose to use case study approaches drawing out of the very classic sociological studies to illustrate how problems and methods had to be selected in relationship to each other. So I had a deep respect, a kind of special intellectual relationship with Matilda before that year.
This was back in college that you'd read this?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right, back at Franklin and Marshall. It was the first time that I'd spent any major block of time with her, and so it was a delight to learn from her directly about her thinking on about aging in particular, and the sociology of aging. If there was one person that year, however, who was had a profound effect on my future agenda and my new set of aspirations for myself professionally, it was Paul Baltus. And we fortunately and fortuitously had adjoining offices. Our studies were next to each other. And we spent every noon hour running in the hills around the center together. So we had a daily peripatetic seminar that I'm sure rivaled the best of the Heidelberg opportunities, except we ran instead of walked. And discovered a lot of common ground. Baltus was searching for a way to give to developmental psychology a richer context, a richer social context, to more than just move developmental psychology out of the laboratory into the real world, but to see development as a product that is shaped and created by, not just shaped, created by social conditions. So that if we think of development as progressive change, to see that progress, the stages it goes through, the rate at which change is encountered typically, as at least potentially the outcome of social and cultural influences as it is of bio and perhaps genetic influences. Searching for a way to do that, he was. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of my agenda, too. As a sociologist, it always occurred to me that many of the outcomes that psychologists described or labeled as development could just as easily have emerged from age-graded social institutions and conventions as from the unfolding of some biological time clock that bore some relationship to chronological age. And Baltus's specific empirical focus was on psychometric intelligence, particularly the performances of older than middle-aged adults, indeed quite old adults, on tests of various forms of intellectual ability, called psychometric because they are in many ways the kinds of mental abilities that are picked up by IQ tests, for example. And what he was finding in his research was that older people were surely doing less well than younger people at some tasks, particularly the tasks that called for novel problem-solving abilities under conditions of timed performance. They had to produce these rapidly. He was able to show that with the right kind of training, the many of the older adults were able to do very, very well, maybe not as well as the very best of the young college-age students, but certainly their performances increased markedly. And he was able to show that one could remedy these apparent deficiencies in such a way that they would transfer or generalize to other areas of life so that they became more cognitively youthful, so to speak. And we talked about the interpretation of that and the meaning of that for what could well be a reservoir of developmental potential that is untapped by conventional social environments. And we began to think about ways in which the social environments of youth and adults were quite different from those of old age and how that might translate into different outcomes of practice and development of particular abilities. So that's an example of some common ground that we discovered. I had, remember, had this interest in my Duncan years in the development of school abilities in kids. And so the conception of intelligence as a ability to deal with excellence in an area of life calling for achievement performances was essentially the generic definition of intelligence that I used. And that's basically what we both had agreed intelligence was across the lifespan. It's just that the domain of achievement shifts, shifts from school to work. And then it, after work, it shifts to a more diffuse and less well identified area. And we began to think about whether achievement, or excuse me, whether intelligence in old age might bear some relationship to the notion of wisdom, a more pragmatic savvy in how to deal with life in general.
This does sound rather remote from sociology.
Well, it's actually at the core of what sociology is, it seems to me, or could be. I think you're right, though. I part of my own sense of sociology is that it has missed opportunities to deal with fundamentally important questions. But no, it seems to me that the relationship between the structuring of social environments and opportunities across the life spectrum and the emergence of different performances and differential abilities is very much a sociological question. It's very much a social psychological question. But it's not one that has captured the imagination of very many sociological social psychologists. Why I think that my year there and my role as a sociologist in that group impelled me to, or propelled me really to a place of some unique standing in that group. I had sociological training and sociological interests, but I was interested in a set of questions that other sociologists were primarily less interested in than the more macro structural questions. Matilda Riley, for example, was very interested in how age norms and age-clustered life roles get created and modified by social policy, changed by the changing demographic character, the age-sex profile of a society, and so on. Those are very sociological and social demographic questions related to all of this, to be sure. But at a more macro end of the macro-micro continuum, and I found myself at a more micro end, and fewer sociologists interested working at that end of the spectrum. But still, I'd call it it's still very much of a sociological question, albeit an interdisciplinary one. The matrix of social relationships made that year was very strong. They included Martin Seligman, who is coming here to visit me and for a meeting next week. He's a very eminent clinical psychologist, the author of The Concept of Learned Helplessness that seems to have picked up a lot of public notice, particularly when applied to understanding depression, attribution-based depressions. James Fries, who is a physician and has written several books about arthritis, but also on vitality and aging. Victor Fuchs, who is an economist, his most recent book is How We Live, and previously, Who Shall Die? We all have remained in reasonably close contact. It's like a college or high school graduation class or a fraternity or sorority.
Were they in this seminar?
Well, some of them were in the seminar, but most of them were just part of the fellowship mm-hmm. year and were either part of the larger intellectual set that sometimes had lunch together and talked about these matters, even though not formally part of the seminar. Some of us ran together and talked. Some of us played volleyball and talked. It's all really a marvelously encompassing year. It's like being in a monastery. It's a world unto itself in a way, and it develops has the capacity for developing a social life that supports and reinforces the intellectual life, and it's a smashingly rich experience if it works well.
It wouldn't necessarily always work well. I mean,
no,
some
years I'm told it has gone just the other way, where people are very study bound. And not very social, and I guess depending on the balance of introversion, extroversion, and the strengths of egos, and so on, can be either a very cordial or a kind of rocky.
You can imagine
time. So
your wife was there, was she?
Yeah, that's right. The normal pattern is for people to show up en familia, so it's
But she's not a sociologist.
Not a sociologist, and it's rare that spouses who are not academics really enter too much into the other than social life. Those spouses who are academics sometimes experience some hostility. They are sort of caught in the middle. They are of the cloth and yet uninvited, and often relegated either to share a study with a spouse, though that's not widely encouraged by the administration.
No.
Sometimes relegated to the farther quarters. There are some converted garages that are clearly beyond the pale, and or work at home, sometimes getting a temporary post at Stanford to teach or to do research or something. So if one comes with an academic spouse, it doesn't always work as well as either coming alone or coming with a spouse who doesn't have the hope or aspiration to fit into the center, but without an invitation. It was a good year for us as a family, though. Marvelous. to sort of finish up on the network, what was built that year was the strength of this SSRC committee. Many people who were fellows that year became members of the committee and have continued to meet. What was built also was this continuing, less formal network of who knows who. George Valiant was another one of the fellows that year, and Dick Thompson, Richard Thompson, who is a neurophysiologist, just wrote a very popular book on the human brain that's apparently selling wildly. Staying in touch with people like that, sending manuscripts back and forth, meeting them at meetings, and sharing a sense of camaraderie as well as intellectual colleagueship is a very rich part of my experience of academic life, and it's somewhat recent. It's now only, what, 6 or so years. But I cherish it, as you can tell from the way I've gone on about it. It was a wonderful turning point that was coincident with my eagerness and preparation to take a turn, but it was far more of a conversion than I expected, and really has set me in a direction which I certainly hadn't expected to take. I came back from that fellowship year with a quite different sense of who I was as an academic. In fact, never since my time as an undergraduate at Franklin and Marshall and thinking about being a college teacher did I ever feel the pride on the one hand, and renewed zeal to read outside of my own discipline. See, I had learned between Franklin and Marshall in the center to be a sociologist, to dig in, to pick my part of the discipline that I figured I could make a contribution to, bear down very hard, nose to the wheel, and do it. And it was relatively easy for me to do that, I think, because of the events associated with the Duncan years, the explosion of the methodologies that the adoption and diffusion of the methodologies that had been used by Duncan and his students to study social stratification throughout much of sociology, the rise to a position of high respect and indeed almost virtue of the way that social science was done in social stratification of the Duncan Sewell genre. All those things enabled me, and I dare say Bob Hauser too, and others, to do well as sociologists. But I didn't regard myself as a very broad social scientist. I knew how to do that stuff, and I knew how to do it pretty well. But the year at the center reminded me how much I really enjoyed the interconnectedness of intellectual issues, how I responded with a different kind of excitement to the problem in its various connections and manifestations. The problem being whatever the problem was. In this case, it was the issue of development and aging. So when I returned from the center, I came back with a different sense of what I wanted this campus to be for me than I had when I left. I thought that when I came back, I'd be very, very pleased to be in the Department of Sociology entirely, to be in this one of the best, if not the best, departments of empirical sociology in the world. And I was, and am. And it certainly is all of those things. But I came back with a sense that I wanted to have the same quality of colleagueship in other areas of this university, in psychology, mm-hmm. in the developmental area in particular. And frankly, there really wasn't at that time very much interest in the Department of Psychology in developmental questions. Many of the bona fide developmentalists had left about the time I arrived on campus in the late 60s, early 70s. Mavis Hetherington, Ross Park, in particular, were two very outstanding developmentalists who've gone on to great distinction internationally, but left here and were not replaced. And the program went to seed. In that area. So I felt that one of the things I wanted to do for me, for the richness of my local intellectual life, was to try to bring to the campus more interest in and colleagues with whom I could talk about developmental questions. And it was in that connection that I became interested in the Institute on Aging and Adult Life that Martin Loeb was directing. Because mm-hmm. it was one of the places which nominally had the programmatic responsibility to gather up people from around campus, different departments and schools, who were interested in developmental and gerontological questions. From the behavioral and social sciences in particular, but also from the biomedical area. As well, as it turns out, that institute at that time was very heavily dominated by the School of Social Work. Martin was a former director of the school, and many of the programs in the institute were focused on social welfare of the elderly. Not to the exclusion of other interests, to be sure, but certainly dominated by welfare questions and social gerontology, rather than on life cycle questions and developmental questions. Jumping ahead somewhat over things that I don't think are necessarily important to cover here, over the course of the next year or two after my return, I was asked if I might direct the institute.
Asked by whom?
By the graduate school, by the dean of the graduate school, Bob Bach. I had served just as a brief preface to that. I had served for about a year on the faculty executive committee of Martin's institute. And Martin gave notice that he wished to resign. He was becoming very ill. He had cancer. He was about to retire also. And so a search was underway to find a new director. While that was underway, Dean Bach had commissioned a faculty committee to advise him on the future of the institute. Should there be an institute? Does this campus need such an institute? And if so, what should its mission be? What should be its range and scope? And what kind of support should there be in the short run, at least, from local monies in light of what might be available from extramural sources? When that report was filed, Bach asked me if I might be interested in taking it on. I saw it as an opportunity for me to perhaps have some additional influence in raising the amount of attention to developmental questions and to gerontological questions which were rooted in developmental questions. Mm. Just as you might think of treating acute diseases with preventive measures rather than just treating the diseases. Well, in any case. So one of the reasons that I took on the directorship was out of self-interest, was using it as an opportunity to bring to the campus a set of conditions which in some way moved Madison closer to this holy city that I had been to, which was not a very realistic aspiration by any means, but it was a vision. It was a vision. It was a source of some real motivation.
So did you set conditions for being director that you would be able to bring people?
Yes. The conditions were not that I would be able to bring people as a department chair or executive committee might be able to hire new people, but rather I was able to negotiate for some funds to bring in some visitors, for some summer support, for summer salaries to get some people here in the short run, to sponsor some research emphases with local monies that would begin to raise the consciousness of faculty in areas where local faculty could be connected with some of the strong people whom I became acquainted with in my fellowship year, and we could invite them in as visitors. And mm-hmm. So in a way, it was, quite frankly, it was an opportunity for me to invite in some of my former fellows as campus-wide speakers, as consultants on research projects. Not my research projects, but research projects of people connected with the Institute. And as it turned out, was able to work along with the dean of the graduate school and the vice chancellor for health sciences sometime later on. Now I'm jumping ahead another year or two to acquire some new state money in the current biennial budget to actually hire some new faculty members on a part-time basis with matching money from colleges and departments. And we actually did make a couple of appointments now with we as a campus. Mm-hmm. Have made some new appointments in the last 18 months in developmental psychology. And so it's working in a way. The Institute seems to have captured the, I believe, latent interests of a variety of faculty across the campus in these very questions about human aging and matters of the human life cycle and how it's put together and how it changes and why.
So they were here. There were such people here.
They were. Those interests were here, and it was a matter of creating the conditions and incentives for people to really come together, to consolidate, to construct some critical mass. And it's a matter of creating the critical mass that gives people more incentive to do things that they were inclined to do, but the conditions weren't right mm-hmm. to get them to do it earlier. And lately, to add to by an N of two, the faculty who can take some leadership in this area, particularly in psychology.
And how about the old guard who'd been concentrating on social work?
Well, they're still, I believe, I hope they are, think of themselves as a part of the Institute and reasonably active. These aren't issues that have been dropped. They have simply been joined by other sets of interests. I see the Institute as a much more close to achieving the broad vision that Martin Loeb had when he was director. I think Martin wanted all of this to happen. Mm. Martin was a very intelligent and wise man whose own connections with development run to Erik Erikson. I was intrigued when Martin died to go to Erik Erikson's Childhood and Society and read in the preface an acknowledgement to Martin Loeb.
Really?
And Martin was well connected in the intellectual issues that are at the heart of developmental psychology and developmental sociology, as much as he pushed for the welfare of the aged programmatically, particularly as director of the School of Social Work. He had all these interests too. He just didn't quite have enough time to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Martin is another one of the marvelous figures of this campus. There are some very warm and, for me, very special vignettes of academic life. One of them was provided by Martin Loeb when he died. Martin was bedridden and virtually dead. We had invited Martin some months before that to give a university lecture as part of this series of what we call Frontiers of Aging series. He and Fred Seidel, a colleague in social work, had written a paper together. And I'd asked Martin, at the suggestion really of a variety of faculty, that we do this so that Martin would have an opportunity to give his last professional paper. Well, none of us knew at the time the invitation was extended how dreadfully ill Martin would be some months later when this event was to happen. And so as the day approached, no one really expected Martin to be able to give the talk, let alone even, as it turned out, to attend.
Mm-hmm.
So Fred was asked to stand by and give the paper instead. Well, Martin showed up.
Mm.
And he read the paper from a wheelchair, pausing many, many times for strength, and he died 2 days later. It's an incredible performance, just incredible commitment to his sense of professional life.
It's interesting. You're speaking of him that way. I know him slightly, and as somebody exceedingly opinionated and whose opinions one doesn't necessarily respect. And
well, that's another side of Martin. That's
has another nothing side to do with his professional life, then.
Well, it may have also, but I guess I was saying as much about Martin's impact on me,
mm-hmm.
as I was maybe more than commenting about Martin as a comment about Martin per se.
Yeah. I'm glad you said what you said, because I think maybe his that other reputation may be more widespread.
Yeah. I think all of us have the capacity to touch others in quite unique ways, and I think it's important that we tell each other when we help.
Uh-huh.
So the current chapter of my academic life is I think very much put in perspective by the year at the center and the goals that it put on my agenda for return and upon my return. And I think the image that I have of what the Institute on Aging can be and must be for this campus are so much indebted to that particular experience.
So that was by no means an off-the-cuff edge of your activity after you got back. That it was a central concern.
Yeah, it certainly
for you.
Was.
Is that right?
Right. That's right. It was an agenda as important as writing a new book, mm-hmm. or getting a new research grant funded. All of those things were underway too, but I saw them as complementary activities, and we've talked episodically throughout the interview about academic roles and administrative roles and how they get put together. Well, I really see. I think still see at least. At that time, I saw the quest for establishing a very vigorous and intellectually respectable institute as important a contribution that I might be able to make as 10 journal articles or 3 new courses that had standing room only with undergraduates. I guess my sense of what I was a part of was this effort to establish new grounds, new perspectives, and to bring to this campus some of that new look, that new view, that new vigor and interest that I had picked up at the center.
Because it was new.
It was new. Mm-hmm. Exactly right.
It wouldn't have been here all along just waiting to be brought to life. It was
right.
New.
I think that's right. And there was some element of a crusade, I suppose, that in all honesty I must have felt. And I have felt, and that's what's kept me going during the dark periods when the busyness and commitments of people on this campus didn't always encourage them to join the crusade.
Well, how did you cope with that?
Well, in part, there was a hearty band. There were a few who, particularly who were willing to join my version of the executive committee, mm-hmm. who bought the agenda, who were willing to take a piece of responsibility and help. One of the things that really helped was my friends from outside. When I had a Paul Baltus come and talk to give a public lecture and several seminars and speak to small groups, a lot of people showed up, and
they became much more interested in
what the Institute was doing. And when I brought a Caleb Finch, who is an endocrinologist, who listens to or who studies how brains and endocrine systems talk back and forth to each other, suddenly the biologist said, "Is this institute for real? I thought they were a bunch of social workers."
Yeah.
And the ability to have good friends who are willing to take time from their busy schedules and come to Madison and help with this enterprise of creating credibility, creating academic curiosity, bringing attention to an institute that seemed to mean business. Those were crucial resources that go well beyond anything I could have done on my own.
Mm. And did the biologists stick with you?
Some have.
Are you when you say biologists, you talk about geneticists, or
mm-hmm.
mostly,
and biochemists, but I guess I was speaking more generically of people, some of the basic sciences, scientists who are in the medical school, let's say, who may do clinical research, but who are really interested in some of the fundamental, say, physiological, to speak very broadly, aspects or genetic aspects of aging.
And did you feel it incumbent upon you to acquaint yourself with that part of this field?
To some extent. Part of what I read my year at the center was biology. Some of what the SSRC committee exposed me to was that Tuck Finch, Caleb Finch, is a member of that committee. And I don't profess to be fully conversant with many of these things, but immodest things
that's all
right. that I'll say in here is that I'm very proud that that my contribution, my chapter in a book that this Social Science Research Council committee has put together on aging in the life cycle is in the biology section, not in the sociology section. So, no, I don't know a lot of biology, but I know enough to I guess understand at least some of the general drifts and issues and maybe that's all I can pretend to do without being too pretentious. In any case, I have felt very strongly that both because the biology of aging and development is a very exciting and dramatically changing arena right now, and because just as a strategic issue, it's important that such institutes have a strong presence from biology, that it became my very highest priority in expanding the base of the institute to try to work as hard as I could to involve biomedical scientists, clinicians into the institute's growth. The graduate school agreed and allowed me to appoint an assistant director sort of midway in my term as director, Jerry Robinson, who is a scientist from the Regional Primate Center. He's an endocrinologist, and he's been very helpful in helping the institute build ties in that area. One of the high priorities in filling out these faculty positions that became available with new state money that I referred to, quite apart from hiring developmental psychologists, is to work with the dean of the medical school and other deans who will hire biologists or biologically trained people with a link to the institute. So I am both intellectually and strategically committed to building very strong expertise in the campus, in the institute, in aging. Now it turns out some of our very finest pre-Nobel Prize biologists in this campus are doing work that is clearly age-related, but it's not packaged under that rubric. Mm-hmm. Hector DeLuca, for example, with the work in vitamins. Mm-hmm. There are others who are working with bone and joint physiology issues. And of course, this university's greatest strength might well be in the life sciences.
Well, and I'd say
so
it is.
So if this institute is to be a premier institute, it needs to incorporate the strength of the university and so my hope is that somehow over the next decade we will find a way to incorporate more of that expertise and more of that activity that come out of the very best labs in the biological sciences.
So these people are not quite won around yet.
Oh no, and I don't expect, frankly, I don't really expect a Hector De Luca, for example, to much participate in the Institute. On the other hand, what I'd like to see is for us to acquire some resources so that we're able to offer to De Luca's lab a postdoc or two who might be the link, who might take a feature of that work that lends itself more to a gerontological emphasis and put that person to work on that line of work and have it known as a part of the Institute's enterprises. But there's some people who are quite rightly organized and oriented in their science to different scientific rubrics and other professional audiences, and that's quite right and legitimate, and none of us has time to do it all. And so as an academic administrator, I think one has to be quite realistic about goals, but without necessarily having to compromise to the extent of giving up all possibilities of gaining some of the benefits of having this very exciting scholarship going on the campus.
And has it achieved what you wanted? I mean, is it the same caliber of intellectual community that you have had at Stanford? Can't be.
Well, of course not. I mean, nor would one expect it to ever be that. It's just the situation is not
but
the
is
same.
But is it at all?
It's improving. It's much improved. Much, much improved. There are sacrifices, I guess, there are costs that I found that come out of all of this. A minute ago, I said something about time, and the crusader who came back from the hills of Stanford, who had a lot of time and energy and a fresh vision, and is a little tired. And there are things in my own academic program which have languished, books I didn't get to work on, ideas that I didn't get to pursue, research projects that were not as well executed as they might have been because I was off doing other things. And maybe one of the greatest struggles for a middle-aged social scientist is to weigh all of those realities in the balance and still come out of it feeling that it was worth doing, or to feel perhaps that it's worth continuing to do. And I think that's for me right now the dilemma is sorting through success and failure to date in a number of arenas. One of them surely is the many good things and I think modest accomplishments that have come forth in the Institute. But then there's also where I've gotten in my own intellectual agenda that has to do with what I wanted to say and what I wanted to have recorded by this time, and how quickly I want to be able to lay out the ideas that bounce around my head every day. And it's hard to do all those things because blocks of time don't always come in sufficient durations to permit the accumulation and the benefits of continuity in thought. So
you haven't quite managed to do this yet.
No, I don't think so. I think this is. I'm at a point, I think, when it's important to come to the decision about either staying on as director and adjusting my sense of how much I want to accomplish for myself and by myself in research, writing, and teaching, to be sure. Or to push on and say, well, the Institute is on its way. It's time for someone else to give it a new stamp, put it in a different orbit, and go back to the usual routine of teaching and research.
Well, that should be the answer, shouldn't it?
Well, I'm not sure which answer is the right answer for me. And I guess that's the point of indecision where I am.
Well, there's always the sense on a campus that people who are in administration are willy-nilly giving up research, and the suspicion that they do it because they wanted to give up the research.
Well, I think in some senses that's true. There may be the few crusaders who don't see it necessarily as inconsistent with the research, or they see it as a temporary battle that needs to be fought, and therefore the days are longer, and maybe a moratorium in the full pursuit of research can be accepted. But after a while, then the question becomes, what do you do well? What do you gain greatest satisfaction from doing? Where can one make one's greatest impact? What do you want to achieve? What does one want to achieve in the next 5 years? And then maybe to decide to stay on in administration really is giving up research, because it's a recognition that one can't have a 48-hour day, and one doesn't have all the energy at one's disposal, and there are, in fact, are others' lives that are going by, kids that are getting older, and wives that are going off to work and going off to school or what have you, and so at that point, I think. I think it's right to put it that people who stay on in academic administration probably are giving up. The question is what they're getting in return.
Was the paper that you did in 1963, it was a major paper, is that right? The one on biology?
The 83.
What did I say?
You said 63.
Did I? There you are. That's your field. Yes, biography, society, and history.
Yeah, well, that was a an early statement of a more current version of that point of view that actually I've just sent off to a journal. Biography and society and history is a paper that grew out of a couple of these Social Science Research Council meetings in which sociologists and psychologists were playfully at battle over the question of who could explain development. Mm-hmm. Was it something that some endogenous unfolding process, some natural phenomenon of biology? Or was it nature? Or was it nurture? Is it really the impress of social institutions and the timetables that they enforce in individuals' lives, such as the age grading of schools that make kids develop in an age graded way, for example?
And it
was indeed a kind of playful battle back and forth. And as in all nature nurture dialogues, of course, it gets one nowhere. Unless one is really a radical naturist or naturalist, nurturist, environmentalist. And so that paper was an effort to say nature and nurture, but in as sophisticated a way as possible to show how the particular evolutionary background of the human species made it very likely that development as a product is at least in part a function of the way in which social organization has played a key role as an adaptive tool for survival of that species in the niches that it's been in. And without the social organization, without the sociology, so to speak, there wouldn't be the psychology. And then, of course, to bring the biology in a similar way. And it goes on from there. But the effort was to be synthetic, was not to say it's sociology or it's psychology, but rather it's sociology and psychology in a way that hadn't quite been said that before.
Why don't you have anthropology in there?
Well, anthropology, sure, it would be. That's not to exclude them. I was really, when I say sociology and psychology, in fact, those were the protagonists in these meetings. But nature nurture is really what's at issue. It's the in a later paper that's more technical. It's sociogenesis on the one hand, as opposed to ontogenesis, you know, the notion that there is a sort of inherent endogenous unfolding versus a environmentally driven sequence.
You spoke of doing empirical research to prove what you were saying early, mm-hmm. some time ago. Mm-hmm. Do you have a project mapped out?
There are two things which are in various stages of plan. Over the next few weeks, I will be playing an advisory role on the one hand, and then a principal investigator's role on the other, for the National Institute of Mental Health, which is about to undertake a very large and long-term project, beginning with school kids who are about 8 or 9 years of age, and follow them till they become adults. And the purpose is to understand who grows up in a healthy, normal, so to speak, way, and who experiences those tragedies of suicide attempts, drug dependence, and so on. That's at least how at the NIMH is thinking about and justifying the project. But in the course of it, it allows us, those of us who are going to be doing the science, to do two rather new things. One is to take a variety of rather frequent measures on these kids in physiological terms, in behavioral terms, social terms, at least annually and perhaps more frequently. And the second thing is to study their parents and families at the same while that we study the kids. And there's nothing strikingly new about that, except that we're going to try to study middle age, or the phases of adulthood and changes in adult functioning and personality at the same while that we study kids. and that's pretty new. There's never been a large-scale study before in which the proposition is that adolescence, entry into adolescence, is shaped by the process of becoming a middle-aged person, and vice versa, that the experience of middle age is reflected in the experience of one's children's adolescence, and vice versa. To bring into the picture how the features of parents' work life, what they do on the job, how they do it, whether they have a lot of control over what they do and how they do it, has a bearing on what they expect to control at home and how they expect to control their kids.
So are you designing the questionnaire on this?
Yes. I'm part of the... There is a... When I talked about my friends Marty Seligman, again, we're going back to the center cluster. The people involved are Paul Baltus, Marty Seligman, George Valiant, myself, and many others, approximately 12 of us who were in an advisory group, and then a small set involving myself and Marty Seligman and Ann Peterson at Penn State, and Sandra Scar, who was University of Virginia, who were at more of the overseers of the science in a day-to-day way. And then there will be four sites, perhaps Madison will be one of them, in which the data will be collected and analyzed across the nation. Yes. So what's exciting about that is that some of my ideas about the interconnectedness of aging and development will be at issue, as well as how the psychological aspects of development are related to some of the biological ones, and how behaviors affect some of the biology. One of the key areas here is the various manifestations of puberty. We'll be monitoring that particular set of biological transformations very closely, and relating the various component features of that to behavioral changes, social behaviors, and cognitive changes. And we'll be able to see, too, as the project goes on for, it's expected to go on for 10 years or more, as mothers go through their biological changes later in their lives, some of them who will be that old, not all of them by any means, what impacts that has on their relationships to their kids. So it's a very comprehensive study. The second study, in brief, is less well formed at this point, and would be a collaboration, again, with some people at Penn State. Yeah, sure.
Seven.
Anyway, the second project is likely to be at the end of life. Not mine, I hope, but it will take place in a comprehensive retirement community in Pennsylvania, where the Penn State University has a research laboratory. And together with John Nesselrode and some of his colleagues at Penn State, to look at the similarly wide-ranging changes in biology, behavior, social life, and context in a group of 60-plus-year-old people. And there, the issue is how do people cope with the other kinds of changes that are taking place in their lives as they approach death and do die. Again, it's important that I have data at, so to speak, both ends of the age spectrum and study development and aging simultaneously, as far as I think of them as fundamentally the same process that we see, except that we are looking at various orders of magnitude of changes of essentially a growth decline nature. Certainly we're going to see some declines in kids. Certainly we're going to see some growth of a certain sort in older people. We want to watch for how people at the oldest, the later parts of their life, might select some areas to specialize in and gain competence and maintain competence, but gain competence, looking for growth as well as maintenance of the status quo. Also, there are some methodological things that I want to do that have to do with some arcane modeling, mathematical modeling of some of these processes that we can do by taking very frequent measurements and pretend as if we had continuous time monitoring of mm-hmm. things underway. We're going to experiment with ways of getting back to people when they've had so-called critical life events, so that we try to capture change when it's most rapid in its pace. And so there'll be some innovations in data collection, which we hope will set some new standards for how to collect information in processes that you expect to be moving at more than a glacier's pace.
So this is your project, is it?
Well, in the one case, I am, in the case of the first project with the NIMH, a piece of it will be mine in collaboration with some local people.
But the second one?
The second one, I'll be a collaborator. Most of what I think is worthwhile doing of an empirical nature will perforce for me be done collaboratively, because it requires a range of expertise that I couldn't pretend to have. And so I think of these endeavors as collaborations.
I mean, it's not just that you're a consultant to...
No, that's right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. That's right. So that's the picture, almost to the moment. And
it sounds as if your earlier work was almost an aberration in your career. Is that right? I mean, that you sort of getting off on the crest of a wave that happened to be there.
Well, there may be some truth to that. Certainly, as I've told the story, and I guess, frankly, as I think about it, arriving at Michigan was like, as you've put it, suddenly sticking your head up out of the water and seeing this giant wave and body surfing and doing a marvelous job first time out.
Mm.
But if it hadn't been for that wave, Lord knows I might have drowned. To play out the metaphor.
Right.
But maybe I was looking for a different kind of wave. Now having had the benefit of the security that comes with tenure and some experience, to be able to wait around to the right wave comes along. And perhaps you're right. Perhaps it was an aberration. It certainly was an opportunity, and one might say that it was an opportunistic period of my academic life. However, I must say that as I think about these problems and issues of aging and development, there is a context there from that first phase of my scholarly
work. Yeah, well, you did
work.
Say that, yeah.
And it's certainly how I think about things incorporates and benefits from a good deal of that. You see, I suppose if I had persisted, then of course no one would have much questioned what happened in those early years. But I guess I'm not so sure that a good deal of what happens to many graduate students is a matter of a goodly amount of opportunity in the equation that involves opportunity and predilections and prior commitments and so forth. When I give advice to students, about what to do in the early years, I guess I reflect on that opportunity, and I do encourage opportunism on grounds that the time to tenure is really very short. And in these days, which are far more Spartan and discouraging with respect to the support for young people to get their careers going, to get their research underwritten and time bought off to concentrate on research and writing. Lord knows one can't be too choosy among the waves.
Yeah.
And but there is a sense in which you're right to reflect that the topic of my first professional phase seems quite a bit afield from the second, and in some ways by choice. I wanted an opportunity to come back from the center. Now, in going to the center, I wanted an opportunity to spend that year so that when I did come back, I was launched in a different direction. I felt that I had made my statement in that area.
That's what I wanted to ask you.
I thought that I had made my statement in that area. I looked at the new structuralism and said, I don't think that's very interesting. I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Really felt the urge to press on to new ground. And new ground meant, in a way, going back to latent interests that had been shelved more or less when I undertook the Duncan agenda. And then, of course, it was transformed even further, as we've discussed today. But I was looking for a qualitative change. I wanted to put on a new cloak to come back with a new set of things. I designed a new course while I was gone, and wanted to establish a new sequence of things for me to teach and a new cluster of students to try to attract. And so there was a good deal of deliberate changing going on.
In our first interview, you talked about Duncan's having moved from one subject to another over
yes.
several areas,
yes.
and also about Mendel, who didn't.
Yes.
And do you foresee perhaps dropping aging altogether at some point?
Well, I don't for a while. I'm so caught in the excitement of some of the things that I'm thinking about that there is a lot of energy there that needs to play itself out, and unless I find myself bumping up against one stone wall after another, that is, just not being able to make any inroads in the agenda that I have set for myself, and there's some of that. Some of the things are not going well. That perhaps I will feel the need to shift. I expect that that'll come. I expect that I will get tired of this, too.
I was thinking it might be that one would get tired of a subject.
Yeah, I think that there will be a point at which I will want to change. But it's still too new an agenda for me. I'm just now to the point where I think I have gained the skills, the minimal knowledge base, have a sense of the horizon of who's doing what and who's not doing this and that to allow me to make my statement and then move on. I like the idea of the Duncan agenda.
You do.
If we're contrasting the continuous and the discontinuous.
Mm-hmm.
I think it provides new excitements. Also, I think that the day of science is much different than it was when genetics was yet to be a science. Things move very rapidly. Many will filter in to a new field as soon as it starts to get prominence and gain some structure. And so from the standpoint of the excitement of making new contributions, I'd like to be on that, the crest of that wave.
Mm-hmm.
And then, to keep the metaphor going, spin off the board before the wave has died and move on to another one. Now, how long I'll be able to do that, I don't know. But if I had an ideal image of myself as an aging scientist, an aging professor, I would want it to be of the pattern that I think has been typical of Duncan. And Bill Sewell.
Yeah.
Though in a different way that we've talked about.
Maybe that's a good place to start.
Okay.